This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says guarantees on the removal of sanctions are necessary for any agreement to revive the JCPOA. It calls on the U.S. to show political will for a deal. A bomb attack near the entrance to the Russian embassy in the Afghan capital leaves two people dead and several more injured. Canadian police launch a manhunt for two suspected of killing 10 people in a stabbing spree in a remote indigenous community. This is World News from Tehran. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Iran says the negotiations to revive the 2015 nuclear deal could come to a conclusion if the United States shows political will.
If there is a political will and if the United States follows suit on Iran and acts constructively, if they seek to move forward, the negotiations could come to a conclusion in a short time and we can hopefully reach an agreement.
The official says that Iran has conveyed to the EU its viewpoints on the latest U.S. response on how to conclude the talks. Kanani says this is a show of Tehran's determination to resolve differences. The spokesman also said that guarantees on the removal of sanctions are necessary for any agreement. He said that the same goes for an end to the persistent anti-Iran allegations by the IAEA. Kanani stressed that Iran expects the agency to act within its own professional obligations. Iran is warning that it will not tolerate new threats by the United States to maritime security in the region. The chief of staff of Iran's armed forces says that there are reports that the unmanned spying units are being deployed to regional waters. Major General Mohammad Bagheri says Iranian vessels will not tolerate the presence of such equipment in their route and will make sure to counter them. He says Iran will protect its right to freedom and security navigation in international waters. Now, those comments came days after Iran seized two U.S. surface drones in the Red Sea for endangering maritime traffic. A bombing attack has taken place outside the Russian embassy in the Afghan capital. Police says a suicide bomber detonated explosives near the entrance to the mission. Moscow says that two embassy staff have been killed in that explosion. A correspondent, Abdullah Emirzadeh, has the details.
We do not yet know. No one has claimed the explosion, but it is said as people were gathered near the embassy and it was very crowded, they were applying for visas either, or they were processing the visas they had applied before. It was crowded, and it is said that a suicide attacker got close, somehow managed to get close to the crowd, and before getting so close to the main gate, he was shot with the Taliban forces. It is said that the bullets went off the suicide vest and the explosion occurred after the shooting. Sources have different number of casualties and dead. What we know, what is official up to now by Afghan sources, is that one person is dead and 15 are wounded. But the Russian credible sources say at least two Russian staffers were also among the dead. So we do not know exactly how many people have died or how many people are wounded. We must wait on that matter.
Now, same with Afghanistan, at least eight people have been confirmed dead in a quake that rocked the country's northeast in the early hours of Monday. The deaths are reported in the province of Kunar along the eastern border with Pakistan. Authorities expect a toll to rise. They're also reporting financial damage. The epicenter of the 5.3 magnitude tremor was near the city of Jalalabad. The earthquake was also felt in capital Kabul. Afghanistan is still reeling from a strong quake that killed more than 1,000 people and injured over 1,500 others in June. Now moving to Afghanistan's neighbor China, where a 6.6 magnitude earthquake has left at least 7 people dead. It hit the Sichuan province in the southwest. Initial reports show houses in a number of towns have sustained serious damage. Telecommunication lines have been cut off in some areas. Chinese media says over 500 rescue workers have been sent to the epicenter. Several aftershocks in nearby areas have also been reported. Palestinians have held a funeral for a young man who was shot dead by Israeli forces in the northern occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, Tahar Mohammed Zakarna was shot in the head and the legs in a town south of Jenin. He was targeted during an Israeli raid on the town this morning. Arrests were also made. Tensions are mounting across the occupied territories amid Israel's escalating raids and crackdown. Palestinians conduct retaliatory operations to avenge the regime's atrocities. On Sunday, gunmen wounded 11 Israeli troopers in an attack on a bus near the city of Tubas in the occupied West Bank. Remote Canadian communities are shaken by a stabbing rampage. At least 10 people have been killed and many more injured in multiple attacks in Saskatchewan province near the border with the U.S.
At this point in our investigation, we have located 10 deceased individuals in 13 locations in the community of James Smith Cree Nation and Weldon, Saskatchewan.
Police have located the deceased individuals in 13 locations in the remote Indigenous community. 15 of those injured have been transferred to hospitals. Some of the victims are said to have been targeted while others were randomly attacked. The suspects are still at large. The intention behind the stabbing attacks is not known yet. Police have issued emergency alert all across Saskatchewan and adjoining Alberta and Manitoba provinces. A manhunt has been launched for two suspects. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the mass stabbing as horrific and heartbreaking. The UK's Conservative Party is set to announce the successor to Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the coming hours. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss and former Finance Secretary Rishi Sunak have been vying for the seat. Opinion polls have continuously put Truss in the lead. The contest was triggered by Johnson's resignation in July, following a series of scandals that led to several resignations from his cabinet. The winner has to get to grips with the UK's worst cost of living crisis in generations, a double-digit inflation, and soaring energy prices amid the war in Ukraine. Speaking of Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are pushing back Russian forces in the country's south and east. Zelensky says that a counteroffensive Kiev began last week has resulted in recapturing three towns as well as some territory. Now, this after Russian Defense Ministry said that forces have attacked what are called foreign mercenaries in Donetsk in the east. Two bases of the mercenaries were hit by precision weapons, according to the ministry. Meantime, local officials reported Russian shelling on residential areas in the southern port city of Kharkiv over the weekend. No word on the casualties. Clashes erupt in the Chilean capital of voters overwhelmingly reject reforms to the constitution adopted during the rule of the 1980s dictator, Augusto Pinochet. Violence erupted after supporters of reforms took to the streets of Santiago to show their anger. Riot police used water cannons to disperse the ralliers. The reforms proposed by the incumbent president were rejected by 62% of the voters. The opposition has hailed the outcome, calling it a defeat for the government. The new constitution was proposed after the 2019 student rallies that morphed into wider discontent with the country's economic system. Confusion over what the new constitution would be like reportedly led to its defeat. President Gabriel Boric has vowed to continue working to change Chile's political landscape. The U.S.'s history of occupation and intervention in Latin America spans almost 200 years. The U.S. has been present in countries from the north of the continent in one way or another to achieve its own goals. But now the latest U.S. attempts to intervene in Cuba's affairs have drawn a backlash from officials there.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers, like the USSR at the time, leading them and getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo. It's a State Department memo that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as the wording is actually as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
Joe Biden's funding of millions of dollars to opposition groups is just one of Washington's strategies to topple governments in Latin America. According to one source, there have been 41 U.S. interventions in one form or another in Latin American countries. Now, one country where the U.S. has heavily but abortively pushed for regime change is Venezuela.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing to impose its own financial rule on other countries. The United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them.
Well, two people have been confirmed dead in the U.S. state of California as firefighters battle fast-moving flames in the northern mountainous areas. The two fell victim to the bushfire that began a lumber mill in the north. It's almost doubled in size since Friday, triggering evacuation of at least 1,000 residents. Strong winds are also fanning a separate wildfire in Siskiyou County, increasing its size. A state of emergency has been declared in the area. The two blazes have destroyed some 100 structures. California has seen its largest and most devastating fires over the past years amid a period of extreme drought. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic Divide. It is a crisis of mammoth proportions for Europe, worse than inflation, worse than energy prices. Europe is experiencing a kind of drought not experienced in 400 years, and the European economy is taking a further beating as a result. How much pain can Europe experience before it bursts? Hi, I'm Kavit Tahwai. Those are just some of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, the European drought, worst in 500 years. 47% of Europe is under warning conditions. A clear deficit of things like soil moisture. How much of a beating can Europe's economy take from that? The European drought's consequences: it has impacted electricity generation, it has disrupted transportation, and it has displaced thousands as a result. And then we will take a look at the European economies. There have been widespread income losses as a result. It appears that no sector is actually spared. Agriculture, financial institutions are just two examples.
Europe is now going through one of its worst droughts in years. Experts believe this is the continent's worst such event in 500 years.
It means that something's changed and something's gone wrong, that we're seeing both heat and dryness like this. So personally, I'm concerned that this is only going to get worse and that the UK is going to have to adapt to hotter weather as we have more and more summers like this.
Major rivers across the continent are also at their lowest levels in years.
Well, we're started our holiday to walk the Thames path, and we started at Thames Head at the start of today's morning, and we haven't found the Thames yet. As you can see, it's completely dried up all the way.
Waterways like the Rhine, Danube, and Po have dried up or have been reduced to trickles.
Online social media posts on this topic were directed at the governments for either not doing enough or for them to not have taken previous warning signs seriously when it came to, like, climate change, for example. And how ironic that climate change actually is not the topic of concern anymore, at least for now, because surviving and weathering out the energy crisis is what people are worried about. All right, let's take a look at our first post. Europe is experiencing its worst drought in 500 years. A staggering 64% of the European Union is experiencing drought warning or alert conditions, including much of England, Italy, Ireland, France, Spain, Germany, and many more countries. Next, we are getting mass murdered by our own governments, enforcing the opposite of an economy. Even as hundreds of rivers are disappearing and our food chains are collapsing, we're being governed by the worst criminals in human history. Next, worst drought in Horn of Africa and China since records began. Worst drought in the U.S. in 1,200 years. Then worst drought in Europe in 500 years. And all of this is happening in the third year of a record cool La Niña. And still most people are oblivious to this new reality. This shows how drought is not just a problem for Europe. And finally, the drought in Europe, 47% of the EU territory is in warning conditions, and 17% is in alert conditions. This has serious impact on food production and river transport. Horrific timing when already a food crisis and high energy costs with the Russian invasion, or the Russian war as we call it, of Ukraine is happening. Okay, let me introduce our guest for our first segment of the Q&A. Professor Piero Lionello joins us. He's a full professor of oceanographic and atmospheric science at the University of Salento. He's also the chair of MedClivar, a network of scientists and climatologists focusing on the climate of the Mediterranean region, and also a member of the MEDEC project, awarded Council of Europe's 2020 North-South Prize in 2020, who joins us from Lecce in Italy. Professor, welcome. Given the capacity that you have in terms of your specialty, the drought that's happening in Europe is pretty severe in terms of the intensity and the longevity that we're looking at this point, which is set to persist for a little bit more time. What kind of effect is that going to have on the economies in Europe? And what can governments do to try to deal with this, especially when it comes to people's income.
Yeah, of course, water is an essential good. It's essential for the functioning of human societies. It's essential for ecosystems and for individuals. So lack of water or decrease of water with respect to the regional standards is always a major problem. And there are sectors which are directly involved. The most obvious one is agriculture, but also energy production. And also there are indirect effects on tourism as and on the environment. And the effects are not just on the economy, but also on the cultural and on traditions, as you are actually eventually experiencing. You know that the glaciers in the Alps are experiencing a very severe contraction. Then you can also lose environments and landscapes that are perceived as part of a cultural heritage, as part of a cultural of different countries. So, of course, agriculture is the most affected, and clearly there is a damage. Now, actually, agriculture is not the primary source of income for most of the European countries that are presently affected by this crisis. And maybe I can anticipate some of the other questions that you might pose. And there is a lot of potentials for adapting and contrasting those effects. But in general, of course, they are posing a severe stress on several sectors and on individuals and on human society in general.
Indeed. Obviously, lots of sectors are affected by this. Okay, our next guest is Dureid Mahasne. He's an environment and water expert who holds a PhD in hydrology and marine sciences. And he joins us from Amman, Jordan. Welcome to the program. The current drought has a significant impact on people's livelihoods when it comes to the way that it is affecting their lives, because we're already looking at a strained economy when it comes to Europe, what with the pandemic and, of course, the inflation crisis that is gripping many, if not all, European countries. What kind of consequence will we see in terms of the economic impact of this drought for people's lives?
Well, countries in such crisis, and we have witnessed this year, there is an inflation, lack of water, high temperatures would definitely have a negative impact directly on tourism. And tourism is a very important line in any country's economy. And we're talking particularly on countries that depend on having good weather for tourists to come to, Spain, Portugal, France, etc., and Italy. So that is the first major issue. To add, the heat would definitely affect a lot of production in agriculture, and thus not only tourism, the supply chain would be disrupted.
Time now for our Info News section of the program. This is where we cover news from around the world. First off, let's take a look at income that Russia is generating. That is something that made news, not in the way that you think, however, because many were surprised. Still earning billions from U.S. trade. That's right. It comes in spite of Washington imposing a long list of restrictions on Moscow. Over 3,600 shipments of wood, metals, rubber, and other goods actually arrived at American ports from Russia since the month of February. So there you go. That's how good sanctions are. Next up, something that is plaguing the EU as a whole, recession. In this case, the Eurozone, which is already in a recession, is what this news says. And it says the energy crisis has led to the economic downturn. Nothing new there. However, this is what's important. The Eurozone economy will reportedly contract by 0.1% for the third quarter and by 0.2% in the fourth. So two consecutive quarters of negative contraction equates to a recession. We're going to take a look at something that you're not familiar with. It's called the high seas, and this is something that was called a missed opportunity in which there was no agreement on these talks, a zone that encompasses almost half of the planet. Negotiators have been trying for 15 years to agree on a legally binding text to address the multitude of issues facing international waters, which includes, obviously, fish in the water. And we thought that this would catch your attention, as it did with us, regarding poverty. 736 million poor people around the world struggling to survive on $1.90 each day. Now, in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic and poverty, the source is seeing micro-businesses collapse and families lose their only source of income. Those were the topics we chose for this section, the InfoNews section. Please do send any topics that you deem important or from where you are. We would really appreciate it. Contact information is on your screens now.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Let's try to get a breakdown on this in terms of an analysis. Our guest joining us for this edition, Professor Piero Lionella. He's a full professor of oceanographic and atmospheric science at the University of Salento, who joins us. Professor, welcome. Taking a look at what is happening to Europe, it's quite astounding. And then in terms of the analysis, it's indeed far-reaching for the climate change via the result, which has been this drought. What are the different type of characteristics, and how bad will the society as a whole get affected by this in the way you see it?
Well, you know, there is an experience everywhere in the world that general natural disasters by themselves are not enough to trigger social crisis, especially in well-organized countries. Governmental institutions, public institutions, organizations of citizens have a lot of capacity on preventing actually the crisis hitting those that have lower means for facing it. So I would say, if you ask my personal opinion, it depends what you mean by social crisis. What do you mean by social crisis? Clearly, a damage and some reduction of income will undeniably occur. Social crisis would be something very surprising in well-organized countries, in democratic countries, where citizens can elect their representatives. But in general, there is a strong capacity of central governments to act in such a way to compensate for those hazards and reduce risks.
Okay. Well, Professor thinks that governments are equipped to actually deal with that. So social crisis may be somewhat far-fetched. Dureid Mahasne rejoins us, environment and water expert, to see whether he thinks the same or not. Dureid, welcome back. The economic crisis as a result of the drought is multifaceted. Agriculture, water, energy, things of that nature are obviously affected, but that pushes people's lives to the edge, not only economically, but just in terms of survival. What are we looking at when it comes in terms of the chances, that is, of a social crisis evolving out of this?
Well, definitely, this is a crisis in the beginning, actually. We haven't seen the worst yet, and it would lack of water would result in socioeconomic instability. Let's start, first of all, by worrisome and households, people would not get enough water for their needs. Secondly, there are economic consequences in tourism, in industry, in so many other factors. So it is not an easy factor. It is not an easy crisis, and it would increase. And worse is that, say, the link between clean energy and water is not available.
The economic cost of the drought is expected to put the governments under more pressure. Extreme weather is affecting livestock producers who are already grappling with rising grain and energy costs, plus labor shortages and disease outbreaks. That has already affected meat markets across the continent. Dairy farmers are in a similar predicament. Problems caused by drought may lower their output in the coming months. That in turn will increase the price of dairy products, which are already rising.
Drought in Europe. Who would have thought that Europe would be battered by it? In addition to the fallout from the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict, things are looking pretty bleak for the continent as a whole, but the current heat wave is not unique to Europe as a whole. There have been numerous other heat waves that Europe has experienced in the past. Perhaps many are not aware, but the European heat wave of 2003 was blamed for more than 70,000 deaths. Subsequent heat waves in 2006, 10, 15, 18, 19, and 2020 killed thousands more. This brings about the question, why are heat waves so common in Europe? The fact of the matter is, Europe is warming disproportionately fast. Europe has warmed by nearly twice the global average of 1.1 degrees Celsius. Recent European heat waves reached temperatures 3 to 5 degrees higher than was recorded prior to the current period of climate change. Currently, that stands at 1.94 to 1.99 degrees Celsius, hotter on average than the pre-industrial average. Remember these headlines? How can anyone forget them? This is what Europe was faced in the past few years. Courtesy of the European Commission, a first-ever pan-European quantitative assessment of the economic impacts in Europe is presented in the next infography to show you the economic damage from drought. Four regions are covered here. Northern Europe, called the Boreal region, Southern Europe, referred to as the Mediterranean region, Eastern Europe, referred to as the Continental region, and Western Europe, which is referred to as the Atlantic region. The losses are based on 1.5, 2, and 3 degrees Celsius. The 31 billion euro loss is what Europe is looking at yearly with a 2 degrees Celsius global warming, which is the average for Europe. And that does it for my section. Hope you found our piece informative. It was nice seeing you again.
The European drought will end at some point, leaving behind devastation to certain sectors. But the real test for Europe and the UK will come this winter, when they will be dealing with high energy prices. The will of the Europeans is being tested. It is up to their officials to see how they can help their own citizens instead of being led down a path that forces them to dish out money to the outside instead of spending it on the inside, on their own citizens. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Mikko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Noor Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you to the studio and, of course, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Now, dear Sheikh, I wanted to ask you some questions about the final point you made in the previous program, where you said that Allah is also, as an example of his protection of us and how he maintains and caretakes the universe, you said he also protects us from celestial dangers. If you could please illustrate what exactly you mean so we can get a clear idea of how it is he is protecting us, dear Sheikh.
Of course, that I gave you the a little example about this issue, about the maintenance of human being or protection of human being against the danger. But I would like, I just wanted to focus on the weakness of human being. I just wanted to say that if you reflect on the creation of the human being and to understand how weak this human being is, you can understand the creation, you can understand the, you know, and go to the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And on the other hand, if you look at the complexity within this human being, and of course complexity within all creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you can easily understand the, you know, existence of the Almighty, All-Powerful. But I gave you the example of the protection of human being and protection of this planet,
right,
and this universe from all celestial dangers. I want to say that,
because it might seem a little bit unclear to somebody who hasn't looked into this, so if you could please just explain it in a simple manner.
I want to say that, you know, this planet and this universe, it is impossible to be safeguarded against all dangers except by management and maintenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You may call it chance, you may call it, I don't know, you know, explosion, or, you know, any other natural, you know, phenomena you may call it. But I want to say that it is impossible for this universe to be safeguarded against all dangers that have, okay, in this, you know, universe. It is impossible to be safeguarded except by the maintenance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay? It is Rabbul Alameen, the owner and the maintainer of this universe, who have safeguarded all this universe from all these, you know, to be perish.
Okay, right.
And of course, you can have this example in different phenomena and different creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I just started from the creation of human being, and I can give you many other examples,
right,
that why we have and we need Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, we have many other explanations attached to that.
Many arguments and reasons, but dear Sheikh, there is something remains unanswered, and that is, why do we say that Allah or God is one? We do not say there are multiple gods, like many previous civilizations believe, and some still believe today. Like the Nordic countries back in the old days, the Vikings, they believed there is a god of thunder, a god of all kinds of different stuff. Why do we say that's not possible, there is only one God?
It is because it is impossible for God to need another God, okay?
Right.
Because when God needs and requires something from another individual, so the first one is, you know, demanding, needing. It has some kind of weakness within it.
Right.
Because when I have some limitation, when Allah, for example, has some kind of limitations, and he requires something from another God, so there is a weak point and deficiency and limit, you know, some kind of limits within first God. And it is impossible for God to have any kind of deficiency.
Right. So that's put very briefly why we believe that there's only one God. And of course, we may refer the listeners to many arguments, theological arguments. That you can find, also believe, on the internet, I believe.
Yeah.
Shia Islamic arguments and why we say God is only one.
Let me add only one sentence, because we have in the verse of Noble Quran, لَوْ كَانَ فِيهِمَا آلِهَةٌ إِلَّا اللَّهُ لَفَسَدَتَا. If there was multiple gods, okay, this universe could not be created from the beginning. This universe, right. Earth and the heavens cannot be created, because all God, they have their own, they're following their own interest, and there was a clash, you know, and dispute between these gods, and all of them, they were looking for their own interest, so it was impossible for the heavens and earth to be created from the beginning.
Right.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, Sheikh, so this is yet another argument for why we say God is one. Another thing, dear Sheikh, that we also believe in is that God, he wants the best for people. He is righteous, he is fair, he is justice itself. He is kind, he is loving, he is giving. This is one of our fundamental beliefs in Islam. A question that's then raised against us is, why does so much evil and harm and wars and crime, just evil, exist in this world when the creator of this world is anything but evil? There seems to be a disconnection here. Does God really want what is best for us, or is there something else at play here, dear Sheikh?
Yeah, talking about the evils that we have, and we have them in the, you know, universe. First of all, many evils, they have been created by human beings themselves. For example, the pollution of this universe, or for example, corruption that we see, different kind of corruption, economical corruption, sexual corruption, and so on and so forth. Most of them, if it was not all of them, they have been created by the hands of human beings themselves.
Right.
Or for example, by some individuals, or by some, you know, unjust governments, unjust system. They have created these kinds of disasters for the human being and for this planet. It is granted, because it is very important to have and to establish this issue, that the most of the corruption and the evil that we see on this, in this universe, it has been created by human being. It has been initiated by human being, by the evil soul of some of the human beings. For example, we have دهر الفساد في البر والبحر بما كسبت أيدي الناس. Corruption has been spread all over the universe because of the hands of some people. I mean,
right.
By the,
as know, a result of their actions.
As a result of the actions of some human being. Or for example, ما أصابكم من مصيبة فبما كسبت أيديكم. Different kinds of afflictions that has been inflicted upon human being, it has been because of what your hands have earned.
Right.
Okay.
Dear Sheikh, some might then say to what you're now pointing out in the holy verses of the Quran, they say, okay, true, human beings have created this evil. Why is Allah then allowing this evil? How can he allow a human being to commit such evil against another human being? Isn't that also contradictory to the nature of Allah wanting the best for his creations?
Because it is one of the results of the Nidham Ahsan, which we call it the best creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted this universe, wanted for human being to be free, okay? And to choose. It is very important. It is one of the keys in understanding the, you know, one of the biggest, let's say, point in Islamic theology, is to understand that human being is free for choosing something and for doing that. Of course, we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given him or her this willpower. Okay, it is granted. But after all, it is human being who choose to do something or to refrain from doing anything else. So, for human being, in order for human being to be free, so the result of that is sometimes, unfortunately, most of the people, they choose to go to the, unfortunately, to the wrong path. Of course, if for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in order to have and to given these abilities of the human being to choose, okay, of course, the result of that is, you know, it goes to some of the victims. But looking, general look, the result of that and the consequence of that is more higher and more precious, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to check human being. But going to the natural phenomena, like, for example, flood, like earthquake and different natural phenomena that we have, what is a, you know, how can you adopt that to the justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? You know that, first of all, first explanation of that is this universe that we are living in is a universe of the, you know, clashes, with clashes of different phenomena. You know, different phenomena in this universe has kind of, you know, clash and dispute with each other. Okay, this is one point. Another point is that, for example, look at this flood, look at this, you know, earthquake that we have this in this universe. Because if you look at this from general perspective, you find it per se to be a good phenomena, to be nice phenomena itself, per se, okay?
So an earthquake on Earth that has hit, for example, Japan, is evil or good? How do we measure it? Or do we not measure it?
You know, if you look at this earthquake or flood itself, is a, you know, nice existent. It is a point. Because if you look at these scientists, they can count for you different, you know, positive points about the earthquakes and about the floods, okay? But the point I want to make that, I want to say that these evils are relatives. Evils are relative. They are not absolute evils, okay?
Right.
And I want to say that if you compare, you know, these evils to another phenomena, please remember that this universe has a, it is a universe of clash and dispute between different phenomena.
Right.
So, with a, if you compare it to other things, for example, flood to human being, of course it has some evil attached to that. But this flood itself, maybe it, you know, by its existence, it has no, you know, evil attached to that. I want to say that if I want to summarize what have been mentioned to that, these evils that we call it, for example, some disease, some, you know, earthquake, some floods, it has a lot of goodness attached to that. But if you compare it to other creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you may find some evils, attached to that. But it is not, you cannot ascribe it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, these evil points.
Okay. I thank you for joining us for this very interesting conversation today, dear Sheikh. And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in today. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن. الآن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.